Hello and welcome to PwC's IFRS Talks, your source for all things IFRS. I'm your host, Laura Kennedy. In this June edition of the podcast, we're going to talk about the hot topics coming out of the recent June IFRS Interpretations Committee. And with me today is Carsten Gonsorge, IFRS Interpretation Committee member and IFRS Talks regular. Hi, Carsten.
Hey, Laura.
Okay, so it wasn't the longest Interpretation Committee agenda this time, but it was an interesting one nonetheless. So there were two new questions discussed for the first time. One of those was on energy contracts and the other was on parent-subsidiary mergers. And then there was also a follow-up discussion on a hyperinflation in question that the committee first discussed exactly 1 year ago. And we're going to talk about all three of those today. And then on top of that, just to briefly mention, the committee members, they were also asked to share their views on two ongoing ISB projects. Firstly, about the project direction for business combinations under common control, or BCUCCs. And then secondly, about the project scope for a new project the ISB recently started on reflecting climate risks in the financial statements. And we'll expect to see those coming back to the committee in the future. So watch this space on those two. Okay then, so on to our first topic. So this first one is a new question that was raised to the committee on energy contracts, whether certain agreements are accounted for as financial instruments applying IFRS 9. And this question can come up because whilst financial instrument accounting doesn't apply when a company has a contract for non-financial items for its own use, so for example, a contract to buy raw materials to produce the goods that the company sells, IFRS 9 does apply to some types of contracts to buy or sell non-financial items. For example, that would be contracts such as those held for commodity trading. So, Carsten, can you tell us a bit about what the committee was asked and why exactly are these questions being raised now?
Sure. So let me maybe start with a brief summary of the facts in the submission. Essentially, the submission asked three different scenarios whether the own use exemption is met. So just as a reminder for our listeners, if the own use exception is not met, that means that the contract is accounted for in the same way as a derivative, that is, at fair value through profit or loss. On the other hand, if the own use exception is met, the contract will be treated as an executory contract. That is, unless the contract is onerous, nothing would be recorded until one of the parties under the contract has performed or the own use exception is no longer met. So to give folks a sense of what this is about, let me briefly explain on a high level each of the three scenarios. So in the first fact pattern, in order to secure an entity's demand for energy from renewable sources, an entity enters into a physical power purchase agreement, commonly referred to as a PPA, with a wind park operator, whereby the entity contracts to purchase, say 50% of the energy produced from the wind farm at a fixed price over, say, a 25-year contract term. Now, when the energy is produced by the wind farm, the energy provider feeds the energy produced into the electricity grid and transfers renewable energy credits to the entity in exchange for a fixed price per unit. Now, the total energy demand of the entity exceeds by far the output of the wind park. However, the entity does not operate its production facilities 24/7, but pauses production during night times, on weekends, and holiday seasons. There's therefore a mismatch between the demand profile of the entity and the supply profile of the wind park, and there will be times when the entity is unable to consume the energy when it's delivered, that is, over weekends or during the night when the facilities are closed. As there are no feasible options to store the energy, the entity has to sell unused amounts from its account to third parties. However, as the overall total energy demand of the entity is substantially higher than its share of the energy produced by the wind farm, the question essentially is whether that timing mismatch, which results in the entity selling the electricity into the grid and subsequently repurchasing at least the same volume of electricity back would result in the contract failing on use. Now, in the second fact pattern, the entity purchases natural gas for use in its production facilities. So that the entity has contracted for only, let's say, 80% of its forecasted demand, and so the contract initially qualifies for the own use exception. Now, let's assume that due to the current economic and geopolitical environment, the government of the jurisdiction in which the entity operates called for energy saving efforts, and based on that, the entity has decided to make investments in energy savings, and as a result, manages to reduce its demand for gas by 30%. So since not all contracts for the purchase of gas were needed anymore, the entity now settles some of the contracts for unneeded volumes with its suppliers via a net compensation payment. The question again is whether that unforeseen reduction in demand and the related settlement of some contracts would result in the contract now failing on use. And in the third fact pattern, the entity is able to reliably plan its demand. However, given the dependence of renewable energies on weather conditions, so for example, the amount of sunshine at a particular point in time, the output of, say, a solar farm can only be estimated with certain probabilities. So for example, assume that with a probability of 90%, the entity would receive no more than its expected energy needs. However, let's assume that there's a 10% probability that the solar farm produces its peak output and the company would receive more than its energy demand. So again, the question is whether the fact that there's a 10% probability that the energy produced is higher than the entity's energy demand would result in the contract failing on use. So these are all questions that have commonly arisen in practice for some time. But recently, these questions have become much more visible and caught much more attention, mainly as a result of the increased use of renewable energies. And also the fact that for renewable energies, the level of energy productions are quite volatile, cannot really be controlled by either party, as it primarily depends on the level of wind or sunshine, in combination with the fact that electricity cannot be stored at reasonable costs, is creating an additional layer of complexity here.
Thanks, Carsten. So very topical and potentially not something that was considered when IFRS 9 was developed. So can you tell us then a bit, what was the committee discussion on this? Did they come to a conclusion, and what would that mean for the next steps on these three fact patterns?
Yeah, sure. So the staff paper contains some general analysis of the relevant requirements, but did not propose any definitive conclusion on any of the facts submitted. Instead, the staff's analysis suggested that there's not adequate guidance in IFRS 9 to determine whether in the submitted fact pattern the own use exception is met. The staff cited a number of reasons for that, including a perceived lack of clarity around the relevance of the respective market structure. So that means whether the power purchase agreement is in a gross or in a net electricity market, around the time period over which an entity's expected usage requirements need to be evaluated, and to what extent transactions in the spot market subsequent to delivery may indicate that a PPA is not for the purpose of an entity's own usage requirements. So, for example, whether there is a threshold for permissible sales. Based on that, the staff suggested that the principles and requirements in IFRS accounting standards do not provide an adequate basis for an entity to determine the appropriate accounting for PPAs in the circumstances described in the submission, and recommended that the committee refers the matter to the ISB by recommending that the board develops a narrow scope amendment that addresses the application of the own use exception, particularly to contracts for the purchase of a non-financial item that cannot be stored and has to be consumed within a short time interval. Now, there was quite a controversial debate around the suggestion of the staff that the principles and requirements do not provide an adequate basis for an entity to determine the appropriate accounting in the circumstances described in the submission. For background, these words are the relevant criteria in the due process handbook to determine whether the committee should either address the matter via an agenda decision or refer the matter to the board. So overall, many committee members felt that there are applicable requirements and principles in IFRS 9 that apply for the fact pattern submitted. And some members express views about individual fact patterns. However, there was a question about whether these applicable principles and requirements provide an adequate basis to conclude on each of the fact patterns in the submission. So my personal view is that probably not all, but some aspects of the submission could be answered by the committee. So I don't think that there isn't any basis in IFRS accounting standards on all of the questions raised in the submission. However, I think there's a lack of clarity in the standards on some of the aspects of the issues described in the submission. And for some of the fact patterns, more details might be needed to conclude. And also it appears that there are some broader questions involved around similar fact patterns. So after some intense discussion, the committee agreed with the staff's proposal of referring the matter to the board to consider narrow scope standard setting. However, at least in my mind, it's quite important to note that the committee has not concluded on any of the specific issues in the submission. So referring the matter to the board does not mean that there isn't any applicable literature for any of the issues submitted, and entities could do whatever they want until completion of such a board project. So watch this space, and it will be discussed by the board at a future meeting.
Thanks, Carsten. Looking forward to the developments on that one. All right, then. So next, then, we'll move on to our second new question that was discussed at the committee. And that one relates to a parent entity that merges with its own subsidiary and how to do the accounting for the merger in the separate financial statements. So, Carsten, what exactly was the issue that was raised on this one?
So, in the fact pattern described in this submission, a parent prepares separate financial statements applying IAS 27 and has recognized an investment in a subsidiary applying paragraph 10 of IAS 27. That means that the investment is either carried at cost, at fair value, applying IFRS 9, or using the equity method. Now, assume that the subsidiary contains a business as defined in IFRS 3, and the parent now merges with the subsidiary, resulting in the subsidiary's business becoming part of the parent entity. So the question raised by the submitter is whether in the separate financial statements of the parent, whether the merger should be accounted for as a business combination, or whether the merger should not be accounted for as a business combination, and whether instead the assets and liabilities of the sub should be recognized in the parent's financial statements at the time of the merger at previous carrying amounts.
Thanks, Carsten. So then, exact same question as last time. What was the committee's assessment on this one, and what will that mean for the next steps?
Now, outreach as well as additional research done by the staff on the matter indicated that entities do not account for these transactions as a business combination, and instead recognize the assets and liabilities in the parent's financial statements at previous carrying amounts. So the staff outreach did not provide any evidence of diversity in accounting for the fact pattern. As a result, the staff proposed and the committee agreed not to add a standard setting project to the work plan and instead publish a tentative agenda decision that explains that no significant diversity in accounting for the merger transaction has been identified. A few committee members also pointed out that there may be diversity around which carrying amounts are being recognized exactly. That is, whether that would be the carrying amounts at the subsidiary level or the carrying amounts previously recognized at the parent level. However, that was not part of the question that had been raised in the submission, and as a result, the committee did not further address that question. So to summarize, the committee decided to publish a tentative agenda decision, essentially explaining that no evidence of significant diversity in the accounting has been identified, and that entities generally do not account for such merger transactions as business combinations.
Thanks, Carsten. So no very technical analysis to expect from that tentative agenda decision.
Yeah.
Okay, that's great. So moving on then, I think, to our last item. So this is 1 year after you last discussed this, Carsten, and you discussed again a question around consolidation accounting when a parent is hyperinflationary but the subsidiary is not. So on this one, can you share with us again a bit around what the issue is here and what the next steps could be on this matter?
Sure. So this is essentially about two different issues, both of which are related to hyperinflation. Now, clearly inflation is on the rise globally, and there are an increasing number of countries exposed to hyperinflation, you know, such as, for example, Argentina or Venezuela, that have been hyperinflationary for some time, as well as some countries that have become hyperinflationary more recently, such as, for example, Turkey. So the initial issue discussed by the committee was around a fact pattern where a hyperinflationary parent consolidates a non-hyperinflationary subsidiary. And the issue essentially was whether the parent would apply IAS 29, the standard on hyperinflation, and restate the subsidiary's results and financial position to reflect the effects of hyperinflation. On this matter, the committee concluded at the time that there's more than one way to read the applicable requirements in IFRS accounting standards. And so the parent could either restate or not restate the subsidiary's financials. At this meeting, the staff introduced another application question in the context of IAS 29. That related issue is around a fact pattern where an entity has a functional currency of a non-hyperinflationary economy, but presents its financial statements in the currency of a hyperinflationary economy. So for example, say an entity operating in Venezuela has a US dollar functional currency, but presents its financial statements in the local currency of Venezuela. Now, the staff proposed that for both of these issues, the ISB should amend IAS 21 to require a reporting entity to translate all items, that is, you know, all assets, all liabilities, all equity items, all income and expenses, and also including comparatives at the most recent closing rate. So there were mixed views of committee members on the staff's proposals and on the best approach for these issues. Also, I think whilst it was acknowledged by committee members that there's diversity and the lack of clarity in this area, given the current number of projects that are already on the board's agenda, some committee members also questions costs versus benefits of tackling the matter and whether this should be a priority for the board. Now, in terms of next steps, the ISB will discuss the committee's input and recommendations at a future meeting and decide how to take these matters forward.
Okay. Thanks very much, Carsten. And I think that brings us to the end of today's podcast. That was a very helpful summary. So the next IFRS Interpretations Committee meeting is going to be in late September. We expect we could see three topics coming back that month that you might remember were first discussed in March. There was an insurance question on premiums from intermediaries, a question on guarantees over derivatives, and another on home loans to employees. So we'll be taking a summer break here at IFRS Talks over July and August, and we will see you again in September. Until then, happy accounting.
The preceding programme was brought to you by PricewaterhouseCoopers LLP. This content is for general information purposes and is not a substitute for consultation with professional advisors.